from National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Mike Waters, and this is Option.
Baby Doolally, my child, one and one made you. So right away we make you cry to show you who is who. Oh, little child of love, I won't give.
Talk about the Spanish Inquisition. No woman who has borne a child would have to fear it. It must have been a mild sport in comparison. Relentless, cruel, knowing no release, no pity. This terrible unseen genie had me in his grip and was in continued spasms tearing my bones and my sinews apart. They say such suffering is soon forgotten. All I have to reply is that I've only to shut my eyes and I hear again my shrieks and groans as they were then.
Insidiously, slowly, the bliss of women big with child spread through me. I was no longer subject to any discomfort, any misery whatever. Euphoria, the purr of contentment. By what name, scientific or common, should I call this sense of protection from harm? The feeling must have been quite overwhelming, since I do not forget it. Cheerfulness, contentment, euphoria submerged everything, and over me reigned the gentle animality, the sluggishness that came from increasing weight, and the voiceless demands of the creature that was developing within me.
From the writings of Isadora Duncan and Colette Audrey, as read by Esther Fowler and Martha Rhoda, respectively. Childbirth. It's perhaps as different today from when those experiences were recorded, as were the two women's descriptions of that same experience. On this edition of Options, Childbirth Today, a report by Mark Poindexter of member station KCUR, Kansas City, on what's new in this ancient and enduring event.
Pregnancy, labor, delivery, and the parenting that follows are now seen as very much the affair of not only the mother, but of both parents. One of the most common expressions among doctors and nurses involved in obstetrics is family care. I talked to Barbara Clancy at Kansas University Medical Center about family involvement in maternity care. Mrs. Clancy is chairman of the maternity nursing department at KU Med Center, an associate professor in the Kansas University School of Nursing, and an assistant professor in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology. Mrs. Clancy said women today are better informed about the biological aspects of giving birth. She also said they are less alone with the maternity experience.
To me, family-centered childbirth means involving other children, if there are children in the family, and certainly making the husband a very active part of this, whether it's in really understanding what's going on physiologically, emotionally with his wife, being involved with labor and delivery, and certainly getting involved with that new baby very early. You know, I mean, like delivery room and right then in the hospital being involved with bathing the baby possibly, being there when the woman is feeding the baby. If it's breastfeeding, being there when she's feeding it and maybe even feeding it bottle feeding in the hospital.
Perhaps the most striking aspect of the changes that have occurred in American maternity care is the increased involvement of the father. Few societies have included him in the past. Anthropologist Margaret Mead surprised many people when in the early 1930s she visited New Guinea and found that the Arapesh culture there believes birth is a process which equally involves the man and the woman. She writes in her account of life among the Arapesh, "The verb to bear a child is used indiscriminately of either a man or a woman, and childbearing is believed to be as heavy a drain upon the man as upon the woman." After the birth of his child, the Arapesh man is not running from friend to friend handing out cigars in celebration of what his wife has done. Margaret Mead writes that after the child is born, washed, and the afterbirth placed high in a tree because of its magical properties, the father lies down next to his wife and their child. In native phrasing, he is then in bed having a baby. She says the father lies quietly by his wife and child and from time to time gives the new mother little bits of advice. Postnatal taboos exist in Arapesh culture, but it is not the woman alone to whom the taboos apply. She and her husband observe the same rites following birth. And Arapesh culture firmly recognizes the father's involvement in birth. Margaret Mead says that if one calls a middle-aged man good-looking, people will answer, "Good-looking, yes, but you should have seen him before he bore all those children." Now in our culture, men too are helping with more in the procreative process than just conception. In prepared childbirth classes, mothers and fathers-to-be practice together the techniques that will help make labor and delivery easier. Sometimes called natural childbirth, the prepared method attempts to involve the mother, and usually the father, in assisting the new child make his entrance into the world. Many hospitals offer training for prepared childbirth, and one of the most common methods is the Lamaze, named for the French physician who popularized it. Dana Lanier, who instructs expectant parents in childbirth preparation classes at St. Luke's Hospital, explains how the preparation helps make births easier.
It's a method whereby we instruct both the mother and the father to use what we consider coping tools to work with their labor and in the delivery itself of their infant. Some of these tools would include such things as relaxation, total body relaxation, concentration, concentrating on a focal point, which is a stationary object within a room, and doing what we call breathing patterns. And there are various breathing patterns that one would use according to how their labor is affecting their body. Obviously, a woman is going to still give birth to her infant, but using these coping tools, she will experience a much more comfortable, a more relaxed, and a more awake and aware labor and delivery process. Medication can be used. We feel that by allowing a woman to understand what is happening to her body through the labor and delivery process, by letting her use these coping tools, by encouraging her to use these coping tools, that she will perhaps require less medication, because instead of always asking for medication, she will be in fact using these tools, the breathing, the relaxation, the concentration, and therefore will require less medication.
Mrs. Lanier also talked about the father's presence in the delivery room, which is encouraged at St. Luke's.
The father is half of the team. He's a very, very vital part of the team. He has a very significant role to play. His role is twofold. It's physiological as well as psychological. Physiological support is primarily that of providing physical comfort measures for his wife. Perhaps massaging her back if she's having discomfort in her back, helping her change positions frequently so she does not tire in one position, providing a cold, damp face cloth so that she can, you know, wipe her face or her neck if she becomes very hot. Labor is work, and therefore women do become hot, and this is most well appreciated by the female. He'll help her time contractions, and he'll coach her through each and every contraction, with contractions beginning, relax your body, get your focal point, begin breathing. After 15 seconds have passed, he'll say your contraction perhaps is increasing in intensity, increase your concentration, maintain the breathing pattern. Gets to the peak of the contraction, he reassures her that the contraction is at its peak, it will get no stronger, then letting her know the contraction is starting to go away. She can slow her breathing or whatever the situation calls for until the contraction ends. The father, the husband, knows this woman as no other person does. He's lived with her, he's loved with her, and knows her idiosyncrasies. The fact that he's there, his mere presence, is insurmountable assurance to her. The fact that he's there providing support, and almost more than support, encouragement, telling her she did fantastic. Everyone likes a compliment, and his wife at this point in time is no different. Just the encouragement, contraction after contraction, you did a fine job, I think is value that can be measured or given by no one else but him. After the baby is born, the mother's and the baby leave the delivery room together, the father walking along the side of the bed. At this time, the mother's taken to the recovery room area. The baby is taken on down to what we call the admissions nursery, where it is weighed, measured, and routine admission care administered. The baby remains in the admissions nursery for a 24-hour period. During this time, the baby is closely observed. It is taken out to the mother at feeding times, but then must return to the admissions nursery. Once the first 24 hours have passed, then the baby may be taken to the mother's room and may remain with the mother as long as she desires. The father is welcome to come to any part in the maternity area when he wishes. In other words, if he would like to come in the morning, because maybe he works the evening schedule at work, he's more than welcome in the morning. If he can only come late in the evening, again, this is fine. He is never restricted from visiting with his wife.
Mrs. Lanier said that hospital procedures and attitudes by maternity care professionals have changed rapidly in the past few years. She noted the increasing enrollment in the prepared childbirth classes.
We started our classes here over 2 years ago. And I might just point out, at that time, in 1973, we had approximately 240 couples take part in our prepared childbirth classes. We generally average around 2,400 deliveries a year. In 1974, we had 860 couples participate in our classes. We have a projected total for 1975 of over 1,000. This will be almost 50% of our deliveries.
Prepared childbirth classes are also offered at KU Medical Center. I talked with Barbara Clancy there about the classes and her views on maternity care.
Has the attitude of parents changed? Do they want to be more involved now? And is that what is causing more prepared childbirth classes to be offered and more people to take them? Or is it simply a matter of them being available and them being referred by their physicians to the classes?
I think it's probably a little bit of both. And there's been so much in the literature, so much on the communication media, whether radio, television, movies, whatever, about families being involved. And I think also in nursing education, this has been stressed more and more. Nurses want to do this kind of thing. They make it available. So I think it's a little bit of both. And I think also physicians realizing the type of education that is going on in the programs, that this really is very sound, and that patients really benefit. So we're having more and more referrals from physicians.
In maternity care, we have not only a changing attitude of mother and father, but also changing roles for both the doctor and the nurse. How have these roles changed, and what can we expect perhaps in the future?
Well, I would say that there's been a great deal of emphasis on patient teaching. And this has not really changed so much in the last 10 years. There's always been this emphasis. But more and more, I would say nurses are probably following normal maternity patients. In other words, they may be seen by the physician for initial exam early and then followed routinely with the regular screening that has to be done for the pregnant patient for, trying to spot any problems that she might have and alleviating it right away, doing follow-up home visiting if need be, and then referring to the physician if there are any problems, or referring to the physician possibly right before delivery so she would become familiar with the physician that will be delivering her. Now, there are many physicians in the area who are hiring nurses to do this very thing because they don't have the time to do the teaching that needs to be done, and also making the home visits, and also staying with the women in labor. You know, the physician often, sometimes he can stay there and sometimes he can't, but hiring nurses to stay with that particular woman in labor, and then she's known her all the time in antepartum. So this is very rewarding, not only for the patient and family, but also for the nurse. The nurses that are in these roles are finding that they're getting very, very busy, and just as busy as the physicians. So they feel like they almost might need another nurse doing this very same kind of thing.
Have you noticed any changes in the attitude of the general public toward childbirth?
Well, I think possibly, at least where I've seen it, people expect quality of care, and we're stressing before, we may have been working with quantity, and now we're working with quality, so that it is a very enjoyable and worthwhile experience right from the very beginning and on up through the parenting experience.
Is prepared childbirth education, not necessarily the classes, but learning more about it, learning more about pregnancy and birth, is this something which would be helpful for everyone to engage in, or only for prospective new parents?
Oh, I think it would be helpful for everyone to engage in. In fact, I think that these type of classes should be taught in maybe even junior high school, and especially junior or senior high school. But I would like to see them start in junior high. And the concepts taught in elementary school as far as family living kinds of courses. And whether anyone ever plans to have any children or even plans to be married, I think these are good courses to take so that they understand what their neighbor who is married is going through.
Is the use of the father as a labor coach essential to the Lamaze method?
I don't think it's essential to have the father. I think it is helpful to have someone else as a coach. Say, for instance, the husband is out of town, or if a woman is not married, possibly they can have a relative or a good friend spend time with them, helping them with the breathing. It can also be very effective. We have the nurses in the labor and delivery area who are specially trained with this breathing, and so they can also be coaches.
What percentage of the births at the Med Center, or approximately how many of those here at the Med Center, come following classes in prepared childbirth?
We have about 90 people, or 45 couples approximately, each session. And they run every 6 weeks. We do not run during the summer months, so that gives you some idea of numbers.
Have there been any technical advances in the last few years to aid with childbirth?
Well, I would say one big one would probably be fetal monitoring. And this is electronic devices where we measure the baby's heartbeat, and we can also determine the character of the uterine contractions and also the strength of the uterine contractions. And this is being used quite a lot now in many hospitals. And it doesn't mean that there might be anything wrong. It is just utilized so that we can pick up any problems and alleviate them early. Just to give you an example, possibly the fetal heart tones may go down below what we consider normal. Normal is between 120 and 160, and they may fall down 110, 100. And by just a change in the woman's position, we can then alleviate some of the pressure on the large blood vessel leading to the uterus and leading, giving oxygen to the baby, and we can alleviate the situation.
Is this type of equipment in very common use now?
I would say it's becoming more and more common practice to use this kind of equipment, and it may be somewhat frightening if the woman herself or her family does not know what this is for, because there's a lot of wires and big boxes and screens and this kind of thing. So if she could possibly see this equipment before going into the labor and delivery suite, it would certainly be helpful. And we encourage the knowledge of this kind of equipment and when it might be used in visualizing it during the prenatal classes.
We talked about the involvement, certainly the mother and father. What about other children in the family? Are they included in the birth in any way under the program here at the Med Center?
In the actual birth, no, but we certainly do involve or try to involve the children during the postpartum period. And we have made arrangements for siblings to come up to the hospital and see the mother, spend some time with her when she is in the hospital, and see the baby through the glass so that it isn't such a shock that there is actually a new baby when the baby arrives home. And they also feel that mother hasn't forgotten me and I am important to her. And I think this really aids in decreasing any problems with sibling rivalry.
There's little doubt that many doctors and nurses have changed their attitude about maternity care in the past 10 years. The Childbirth Education Association was organized in Kansas City in 1966. Cheryl Barney, who now heads the organization, said that when the group began, it encountered some resistance from the medical profession, but that today, doctors and nurses often encourage prepared childbirth. She says one reason is consumer demand.
The medical profession at first was very reluctant for fear that perhaps this might interfere, and we got a might interfere with the medical process of what goes on in the hospital and all of this. We had a great deal of support from a few doctors at that point, not much support from the great majority. It's been through experience and through patience saying, you won't allow me to do this, okay, I'll go someplace else. And kind of doctor shopping. Consumer rights kind of thing, patient rights. So that has been a big change, I think, that people now know that they can go someplace that they want, that will do things the way they want to do them. The doctors, many of them fully support it through having experience with it and seeing that patients that are prepared are much easier to work with and have less medication. Nurses, too, whereas they used to come in and try to tell you what to do all of the time while you were in the labor room and force the husband to get out, et cetera, et cetera. They're now very supportive for the most part. Say, oh, you've had classes, fine. You're doing great.
The chairman of Kansas University Medical Center's Obstetrics and Gynecology Department believes that cultural changes have forced physicians to modify their attitudes. Dr. Kermit Krantz says woman's role has ceased to be merely that of childbearing, and that when she does bear children, she wants to be treated as a thinking human being. Krantz also said the way society in general looks at birth has undergone rapid change.
We no longer frown upon people who say, I don't want to have a family and I want to be married. But we do frown upon those who have a family and don't take care of it and abuse the child, don't we? Or children. Or leave them poorly clothed, undernourished. Or beat them. Because this youngster is brought into the world, then that family unit must be maintained at the best we know how to give this child the best of opportunity. And the best way to help maintain this is not make it totally matriarchal or patriarchal as it's been in the past, or child-oriented, patriarchal, but basically between two adults who are participating equally together.
Who first recognized that? Was it the woman who demanded to be recognized as an equal?
I think it's a matter of changes in the culture of our Judeo-Christian tradition of over 3,000 years. We've now come to the right of privilege of the individual. We have now put a real value on the individual life and rather upon groups. We even speak of groups of people, but now we believe in the individual. And the individual now becomes somebody, someone. Stop to think 100 years ago, in 1838, 1 out of 10 women died in childbirth. Today, it's about 18 women per 10,000 from all causes, you see.
And the major reason for that is technological advances?
Yes, health. Industrial advances, medical advances, they're all been hand in hand. Medicine can't claim one corner for it, nor can industry. It's a matter of the improvements we've had.
What type of improvements in terms of
infection,
services?
Antibiotics is an example. Blood, good care during the pregnancy, family planning, so the woman didn't have one child after another, recognizing how pregnancy alters the natural history of disease. The woman with bad renal disease or diabetes, etc., is limited in the number of children she has so she can live. A heart disease patient is now operated on so that she can live.
Right now, where are we seeing more changes?
Our youngsters today, being raised in a somewhat permissive society, also have real senses of conscience to be qualitative. And many of the taboos and things we ignored in the past are now brought out in the open. That we were hung up over many taboos. Sexual feelings is an example in the woman. A woman was not to have any sexual feelings. I don't know why. And she was to perform as a service module and take care of the kids be responsible for all these entities, but not speak out or be a part of the whole public service or the whole social system. If she did have to go to work, pay her a half salary, because she's a half a human, yet she's responsible for bringing in the next generation. What incongruity. United States and Northern Europe are been on the fringe of changing these things over pretty years. But our entire religious background, Judeo-Christian tradition, has been male-oriented.
But you think this definitely is going to end in America and Northern Europe?
It won't end. It'll evolve. Evolution means change. And adaptability of that change means survival.
What does adaptability to this change mean within the medical profession?
Well, I think more than anything, it means that that our family units are going to grow in strength, because children are going to be wanted and not just happen. People are communicating with each other, not because they have to, because they must do it in order to survive, to maintain the common goals they wish. I think we see a premium being put on the whole system of life itself. If nothing else, we recognize out of the Vietnamese conflict that the young person today is a thinking individual. He is just as motivated. He is just as inspired. He wants to succeed just like our generation, but he wants reasons for it. And there must be reasons behind what he's doing.
How easy does the obstetrician find it to respond to an intelligent woman who's coming to him and saying, I want to participate in the birth of this child. I'm not coming to you, just turning it over to you.
The young men are much more adaptable to this because that's what they've understood. Many senior citizens, it's a little bit different because they've never had the father in the delivery room. And it can not necessarily be threatening to them, but it's out of the ordinary. But you know, all of us change. So the physician modifies to the social changes. Who of us would think of contraception to teenagers or unmarried individuals 30 years ago? Today it's a matter of fact. Who would have thought of abortion to bringing it out in the open and discussing it as a real issue, as despicable as it may mean to many people? But the issue is open. The physician has now had to do it. And he too, and must understand, is going through tremendous changes in education. He is no longer an individual who tells you what to do. He is now a counselor, and then carries out in a highly skilled manner the technical aspects. He, too, is going under a metamorphosis, just like the woman who cannot understand that a woman's job isn't staying home all the time and having babies. Or the mother who says, daughter, you go to that doctor because I went to him. Or who never let herself be exposed to her husband. To totally expose yourself in the process of childbirth. And your husband is there and participating in your most though maybe a very rewarding moment of life, but it may be an agonizing moment as well.
This still isn't the most common delivery, is it, with the husband present? That's still
in
a minority of cases?
In this institution, it's extremely high percentage. Extremely high percentage.
You think it's going to become the rule rather than the exception everywhere in the country eventually?
Never anything should be a rule. It should be that which is indicated for those individuals. Well, I see many husbands say, and wives say, no, we've talked it over, and my husband doesn't want to be there. Then don't force him into something. It's just as negative to go the other way.
Krantz also talked about what he thinks the years ahead will mean for his profession.
We will see an even better planning of children. We're going to see abortion become less and less, because adequate contraception and education will be there. We'll see closer participation of the husband. Even now, in certain instances, I let the husband stay with the mother. Why shouldn't he? After they've had the baby. Is there
stay with the
wrong?
Mother on what basis? You mean for 24 hours?
No, sleep in the same room with her. In the new building we're building here at KU, this will be an advantage. The dining room where they can sit down and eat together. There's nothing should be abnormal. She's only there so she gets her strength and we can watch her and help her to gain more confidence and how to take care of her baby. Well, let's make it a participation. Help them take care of their child. It's not her child. It's their child.
When I visited the prepared childbirth class at Kansas City's St. Luke's Hospital, I found that several of its members have had children before under the prepared method and were taking the class for the second time. Most couples were eager to talk about their experiences and their reasons for taking the class.
I feel like I need to know what's going on, and that this was a good way, besides reading books and talking to friends, to really find out the scoop on things.
When I was growing up, I had no conception of, you know, other than, you know, the father sits in the waiting room and the nurse comes out and says it's a boy, it's a girl, it's twins, and so on. And then he gets the box of cigars and passes them out.
If I have a little girl, I want her to have the same good experiences with childbirth that I've had. Because, I mean, I've got a lot of friends that have had really bad experiences with childbirth. And it almost convinces them not to take or to have another baby. But I'd love for our little girl to, you know, when she grows up and has her children, to do it the same way.
I felt the first time that it was very beneficial. I felt I was actually helping the doctor in the delivery, and it was also very important to me that I was awake during the delivery. It helped me a lot because there wasn't quite as much pain as I anticipated. But I thought, other than the fact that, you know, it gave me the breathing tools and everything to work with, it also, even if you were never going to use Lamaze method, it also was very educational. Actually, all of our friends that have had children in the last 2 years since we have been aware that this program was around have gone through the classes.
I think, you know, the father is apprehensive, just like the expectant mother is, and I think it prepares the father not only through pregnancy but also at the time of delivery, and I think it's very beneficial.
And I don't think I could go through it without Jeff. I mean, I'd have to one way or the other, but I'd just prefer he be there.
I feel like I was more prepared, and I think happy after the delivery because I knew more about what was coming.
Relatives, I think, more than people our own age had never, you know, really, this wasn't how they had their children. For instance, my mother and my mother-in-law and stuff, this isn't, you know, this was fairly new to them. So they didn't really understand it. They certainly didn't put it down, but they were, you know, very curious about it.
I'd like to be as involved as possible. In some situations, I've heard my friends say they kind of paced around the father's waiting room, you know, or they spent their time in a bar, and I'd rather be right there when things are going on.
Her parents said that I'd probably faint dead away, and I didn't think a thing about it. I want to go through the experience again, and there isn't anything to compare with it.
Test tube babies are still a long way off, and a nation of superhumans created by genetic engineers is still a science fiction plot rather than a likely possibility. So says Dr. David Harris, chief of the Genetic Counseling Center at Children's Mercy Hospital in Kansas City. The counseling center deals with parents who believe they may run the risk of having children with genetic disorders. But Harris says that for most people, the risk of having children with such disorders is very slight.
For most parents, it's not much of a problem because 95% of births are births of normal children. However, it's for the parent of the last 5%.
What advantage is there to knowing if a person is a carrier of an undesirable trait? What can you do about this?
Well, for some traits, we can identify in an unborn child the presence of the disease. Then, if this is something that the parents can accept emotionally and religiously and ethically, they can elect to abort such an infant.
Do you ever counsel people who feel they both may be carrying undesirable genetic traits and are considering not having children?
Well, I always have a problem with what somebody means by the word undesirable, because some of these traits give rise to disease, but there is an important theoretical issue that a number of geneticists have never really been able to solve, and that is that even though a disease may be undesirable and unpleasant, there may be some advantage to that trait in the population, and it may be a protective mechanism for the human race as a whole.
Would sickle cell anemia be an example of that, a trait that developed as a protective mechanism at one time?
Sickle cell anemia is probably the best understood case. It seems likely that the heterozygote, you know, that is a person who has one half of his hemoglobin in the normal or the usual A state and the other in the variant or hemoglobin S, is protected against the development of severe illness from malaria, the kind of illness that kills people with malaria in Africa is largely cerebral malaria, malaria of the brain area. This is what produces most of the mortality, and the children who have both hemoglobins A and S are protected against the development of cerebral malaria. They get malaria, but they're less likely to die. And this is, many people feel, is the reason that the gene for sickle hemoglobin, or hemoglobin S, has become fairly high in not only Africa, but other areas in the Mediterranean.
What then does genetic counseling involve in terms of decision making?
Well, there are certain disorders that are treatable. There aren't very many, but one of the best known diseases is, of course, phenylketonuria. Most states have screening programs for this disorder in the newborn period, and the affected child is then put on a diet that is low in the amino acid phenylalanine. And this prevents the undesirable development of mental retardation. There is another disorder that involves the metabolism of the major sugar in milk, galactose, and the disease is known as galactosemia. So in certain instances, identifying the disorder in either the child or the carrier state in potential parents leads one to look for the development of the disease in a child and the institution of a proper therapeutic plan. The other aspect of genetic counseling is really based on prevention and on decision making. It's fairly cumbersome because when one comes for genetic counseling, one is subjected to a large number of questions about one's family, which takes a fair amount of time for us to collect the data that we're interested in order to give some idea of what the chance of the disorder is in a particular couple. But our main function is to help family understand what the risk of the disease occurring is, and also to work with them so that both they and the people doing the counseling know what their impression of the disorder is, how they feel about it, how much of a burden is it to them. And what we try to do is help a family take those two ideas, what the mathematical or the probability, the risk is in probabilistic terms, and the burden, which is a much more emotional idea, and try to put those two together and let them come to a decision on what they want to do, and then we try to help them carry out that particular plan.
Is there any way in which a person could pass on an undesirable trait through poor nutrition, through exposure to radiation, through other types of things that they come into contact with?
Well, this is a question that everybody asks, particularly after having given birth to an abnormal child. And that is, did I do something wrong? Should I have done something different? Although some of the things you mentioned, like radiation, can produce mutation, most of the time, parents have had nothing to do with why their child was born the way it was. And we try to reassure people that there is nothing that they could have done to change the outcome. And at the present time, there's no way of preventing these things from happening. A lot of people are talking about genetic engineering and changing genes around, and although there are theoretical reasons why this is possible in certain organisms like bacteria, we're a fair way from doing this with ourselves.
Is genetic manipulation possible in any way with human beings, even on a very small scale?
Only in the sense of mate selection. You know, if you choose a different husband or wife, that will change your outcome. And then the use of artificial insemination. If a couple, once again, one is involved in several highly charged issues emotionally and ethically. But if a parent decides that they are undergoing an unacceptable risk, then this is one way of avoiding giving birth to a child where both of the parents might be carriers of an unpleasant disorder. And I think that's about the extent of our genetic engineering, the use of artificial insemination and sperm banks. The changing of an individual gene within a person's genetic constitution is not possible at the moment.
I remember 3 or 4 years ago there was a tremendous amount of attention paid to these very highly charged issues. You mentioned sperm banks, genetic manipulation, and also something called cloning. What is cloning?
Well, cloning is a technique that's been used in frogs quite extensively. One of the major techniques in the frog is to take the nucleus out of the embryo, the very early embryo, and transplant another nucleus from another organism, another frog, actually, so that the nucleus did not contain genetic material from its two natural parents, but from a totally different individual. This enables one to make identical genetic copies of one particular individual. And that's basically what cloning is, to make identical genetic copies. Whether they're going to turn out absolutely identical is not totally clear, because even identical twins, which have the same genetic constitution, have some differences between them.
What sort of purpose could cloning possibly serve with human beings?
Well, I think part of the idea of the people who discussed this was that this would enable you to copy people who have outstanding characteristics, that you could then have a population of Einsteins or perhaps other geniuses, or people who have outstanding traits in athletics or art or any field that you wish. I think there's an inherent danger in making many copies. If you have a population that's uniform, one is exposing a population to a number of risks of extinction, because the population as a whole won't be able to tolerate a major environmental change. And I think there's been a good example of that for those of us who live in this part of the country, where our economy is largely based on agriculture, and our contemporary agriculture is based on a technique that's been known as monoculture, where one has the same strain of wheat or corn planted over acres and acres and acres, or most of the acreage that is planted. When the corn blight came through a couple of summers ago, all of those hybrid corn, although they had many desirable characteristics, were uniformly sensitive to the corn blight and were therefore wiped out. And a uniform population of human beings would be susceptible to the same kind of problem.
The vast majority of babies may be born normal and healthy, but there are many times when people don't want a baby, no matter how cute, healthy, and well-endowed genetically it may be. People decide for many reasons to plan their families rather than just let them happen. The executive director of the Planned Parenthood Association of Kansas City, Pat Smith, says preventing unplanned children is not just women's work.
Men have been culturally indoctrinated to think that they get in free, in a sense. And so I suppose what we have to do is work a little bit on changing attitudes of both men and women toward whose responsibility this matter is. I'm afraid that the male contraceptive pill is a long, long way down the line. We don't have lots of money for research in contraception. We have lots of money for research in death control, but very little for birth control.
Mrs. Smith also talked about Planned Parenthood's efforts to help people control their fertility.
Planned Parenthood has always been dedicated to the idea that every child who is born into the world should be wanted and loved and planned for. So that's our main mission.
Are you primarily concerned with contraception? Is that where the majority of the time is spent?
That's the main part of our program. Family planning, contraceptive clinics, and treatment for gynecological problems for women which have these problems relative to contraception.
You're dealing primarily with women, I assume, because contraception is still a woman's problem or a woman's concern. What type of contact do you have with men?
We have a vasectomy clinic here. So we do have some contact with men who are seeking to control their own fertility through male sterilization. We also like to talk to men that come with women to our clinics and men who come to our education sessions about their role in preventing pregnancy. Because we believe that it is a mutual responsibility and we can't just shove it off on the women.
Have we reached that point yet where most children are wanted, or are we anywhere close to it?
Interestingly enough, the birth rate among the adolescents has not decreased. Somehow adolescents don't think that they want to get involved in contraceptive control when they first become sexually active. And the consequence is that they get pregnant more often. Apparently, adolescents either don't have adequate information about contraception or they feel it isn't easily available to them.
From a socioeconomic perspective, where has birth control made its greatest inroads?
I believe that birth control has made inroads in all socioeconomic levels. We used to think that, well, it was just those uneducated poor folks that were having all those kids. But studies have shown that less economically comfortable women use contraception just as much as the more affluent portion of the population, provided the contraception is available.
Do you think sex education for children is a prerequisite to effective family planning?
I do know if you don't have sex education, you can't very well do any family planning. In my day, the innocent little child was a value, and that ignorance was bliss, but I don't really believe ignorance is bliss.
IUDs, the diaphragm, condoms, foams, jellies, creams, and a host of other words dealing with preventing conception have become part of everyday conversation. At present, the two most common methods of contraception are the pill and the intrauterine device. I talked about these and other means of birth control with Dr. Harry Jonas, the chairman of Kansas City General Hospital's Obstetrics and Gynecology Department. He talked about the pros and cons of some of the most common methods and also of the prospects for effective male contraceptives.
Presently, the two most frequently used contraceptive methods in women are the birth control pill, which is the most commonly used contraceptive, and the intrauterine device. With the advent of the newer birth control pill dosages, we now have much more wide acceptance of the pill because of the absence of undesirable side effects which are present in the newer dosage pills. The intrauterine device is a good method of birth control, particularly for patients who have had problems with birth control pills. However, the effectiveness or the pregnancy rate with IUDs is significantly above that of the pills. But in effectiveness, the IUD ranks second to the pill.
What are some of the problems with the IUD right now? There are many different types available, and I understand that the danger of infection varies a great deal with the type. Is that true?
It seems that most of the interest recently has been concentrated on the Dalcon Shield because in the case of the Dalcon Shield, there were a number of cases reported of infections arising in women who got pregnant with the Dalkon shield in place. And in those patients, there were some very serious and a number of cases of even fatal infection. It was for this reason that the company which makes the Dalkon voluntarily agreed to having it suspended from sale until further studies could be conducted on that device. Those studies have been conducted. There are presently some changes being made in the Dalkon because it is now believed that the structure of that particular IED makes it more likely that infection will occur. I don't think that all IEDs should be indicted because of the trouble with the Dalkon shield, because certainly that experience has not been present with some of the other IEDs.
Are more people seeking surgical methods to control their fertility now than were 5 or 10 years ago?
Certainly surgical sterilization has become very popular in recent years, particularly with our development of an instrument known as the laparoscope, which is a instrument which has a very powerful light source on the end that can be inserted in the abdomen of the woman by making a very tiny incision, which is so small that when the procedure is over, the incision can be covered by a Band-Aid, so that type of surgery is frequently referred to as Band-Aid surgery. Through the laparoscope, we can proceed to do certain operations on the tubes, which renders women incapable of conceiving. These may consist of burning or cutting of the tubes, or as we're using now, a new technique which involves the use of a ring placed around the tubes, which occludes the tubes. These procedures are relatively easy, short procedures. They carry with them a certain amount of risk, as all operative procedures do, but the patients may come into the hospital on one day, have the procedure done the same day, and either go home the same day or the day following. In the case of male surgical sterilization, vasectomy in recent years, of course, has also become very popular. This is a surgical procedure that can be performed on the male under local anesthetic, usually in the doctor's office or in an outpatient clinic facility, and again, does not involve a long recovery period generally, and is being done under local anesthetic, is a relatively minor procedure. Most exciting new concept in male sterilization has come recently from our own University of Missouri at Columbia, where there is now some research going on regarding the use of ultrasound to sterilize the male. And this promises to be very exciting, I think, down the road.
What does this ultrasound method involve?
Well, the ultrasound machine is simply, it is a machine in which the ultrasound waves are directed at the testicles, which causes the sperm production to be either diminished or reduced to absolute zero.
What do you think the field of contraception will be like in, say, 10 years? Do you think any very significant changes will happen between now and 1985?
When I was in medical school, which was a good number of years ago, we were talking about the development of the male contraceptive pill kind of like it was just around the corner and it's never arrived. My answer to your question about what we can expect in the next 10 years, I think, totally depends on the priorities that the federal government and various other agencies involved in health research choose to place on contraceptive research. In the past, the priorities for good basic research in the field of contraception have not been high. And consequently, I don't think we have made as much progress in this field as I'd like to see us make. Certainly, if you look back over what we've accomplished in the last 15 years in the field of contraception, we've accomplished a great deal, despite the fact that I say that our priorities haven't been as heavy as I'd like to see them. It's certainly easier for the gynecologist of today to give good family planning advice to patients seeking it, now with the variety of contraceptive techniques that we have available. much easier than it was for those of us who were practicing a few years ago when all we had to offer the patients was a diaphragm or a foam.
Technical advances in the fields of contraception for those who don't want babies and in maternity care for those who do have shifted the responsibility for the birth of children from deities or fate as in early societies to the doctor as in the recent past, and at last increasingly to the man and woman who are directly involved in creating and caring for a new human being. In ancient Rome and Greece, pregnant women were sacrificed to the goddesses of the corn and the earth. Later, when they still saw birth as a great mystery, the Romans believed that anyone who sat beside a pregnant woman with hands clasped would cast a malignant spell over her. Even in recent history, some people in Europe and America have believed that all locks, windows, and doors should be opened when a woman is giving birth. This was done on the assumption that the woman, too, would open up and make delivery easier. Today's prospective parents are armed with knowledge, not superstition, when they set out to have or not to have children. In the opinion of many, that knowledge and the choices it offers can benefit both the parents and the child, whose arrival has been not only desired, but even physically aided by the man and woman he will someday call mom and dad. The baby may not realize this at the time of birth, but then again, what he or she does think about at that time is one thing that still does remain a mystery.
Baby, do lie, lay, my child, one and one made you. So right away we make you cry to show you who is who. Oh, little child of love, I won't get in your way. Let me look out from above over you, baby, do not lay.
Childbirth Today, a report by Mark Poindexter of member station KCUR in Kansas City, Missouri. And that concludes this edition of Options. Funding for today's program was provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. For Options, I'm Mike Waters. This is NPR, National Public Radio.